The Rocky Mountain Prison for the Criminally Insane had been constructed in the Great Depression under the auspices of the Works Projects Administration, and it looked as solid and formidable as the Rockies themselves. It was a squat, rambling building with small, deep-set, barred windows, even in the administration wing. The walls were faced with iron-gray granite. An even darker granite had been used for lintels, window stools, door and window surrounds, coins, and carved cornices. The whole pile slumped under a gabled attic and a black slate roof. The general effect, Roy Miro felt, was as depressing as it was ominous. Without hyperbole, the structure could be said to brood high upon its hillside as if it were a living creature. In the late afternoon shadows of the steep slopes that rose behind the prison, its windows were filled with a sour yellow light that might have been reflected through connecting corridors from the dungeons of some mountain demon who lived deeper in the Rockies. Approaching the prison in the limousine, standing before it, and walking its public corridors to Dr. Palmer's office, Roy was overcome with compassion for the poor souls locked away in that heap of stone. He grieved as well for the equally suffering warders who, in looking after the deranged, were forced to spend so much of their lives in such circumstances. If it had been within his authority to do so, he would have sealed up every last window and vent with all the inmates and attendants inside and put them out of their misery with a gentle acting but lethal gas. Dr. Sabrina Palmer's reception lounge and office were so warmly and luxuriously furnished that by contrast with the building that surrounded them, they seemed to belong not only in another and more exalted place, a New York penthouse, a Palm Beach Bayside mansion, but in another age than the 1930s, a time warp in which the rest of the prison seemed still to exist. Sofas and chairs were recognizably by J. Robert Scott, upholstered in platinum and gold silks. Tables and mirror frames and side chairs were also by J. Robert Scott, done in a variety of exotic woods with bold grains, all either bleached or whitewashed. The deeply sculpted beige-on-beige carpet might have been from Edward Fields. At the center of the inner office was a massive Monteverdian Young desk in a crescent moon shape that must have cost $40,000. Roy had never seen an office of any public official to equal those two rooms, not even in the highest circles of official Washington. He knew at once what to make of it, and he knew that he had a sword to hold over Dr. Palmer if she gave him any resistance. Sabrina Palmer was the director of the prison medical staff. By virtue of its being as much hospital as prison, she was also the equivalent of a warden in any ordinary correctional facility. And she was as striking as her office. Raven black hair, green eyes, skin as pale and smooth as pooled milk. Early 40s, tall, svelte but shapely. She wore a black knit suit with a white silk blouse. After identifying himself, Roy introduced her to Agent Allmeyer.
"Pleased to meet you, Doctor."
And Agent Tarkenton.
"Doctor."
She invited them all to sit down.
"Well, thank you, Doctor,"
said Allmeyer, and took up a position to the right of the door that connected the inner and outer offices.
"No, thank you, Doctor,"
said Tarkenton, and took up a position to the left of the same door. Roy proceeded to one of three exquisite chairs in front of Dr. Palmer's desk, as she circled to the plush leather throne behind it. She sat in a cascade of indirect amber light that made her pale skin glow as if with inner fire.
"I'm here on a matter of the utmost importance," Roy told her, in as gracious a tone as he could command. "We are certain that the son of one of your inmates is currently stalking the President of the United States and intends to assassinate him."
When she heard the name of the would-be assassin and knew the identity of his father, Sabrina Palmer raised her eyebrows. After she examined the documents that Roy withdrew from the white envelope, and after she learned what he expected of her, she excused herself and went to the outer office to make several urgent telephone calls. Roy waited in his chair. Beyond the three narrow windows spread out across the night below the prison, the lights of Denver gleamed and glittered. He looked at his watch. By now, on the far side of the Rockies, Duval and his 12 men ought to have settled inconspicuously into the creeping night. They wanted to be ready in case the travelers arrived far earlier than anticipated.
The hood of night had fully covered the face of twilight by the time they reached the outskirts of Grand Junction. With a population of over 35,000, the city was big enough to delay them, but Ellie had a penlight and the map that she had taken from the helicopter, and she found the simplest route. Two-thirds of the way around the city, at a multiplex cinema, they stopped to go shopping for a new vehicle. Apparently, none of the shows was either letting out or about to begin, for no moviegoers were arriving or leaving. The sprawling parking lot was full of cars, but devoid of people. "Get an Explorer or a Jeep if you can," she said, as he opened the door of the Bronco, letting in a frigid draft. "Something like that. It's more convenient."
"Thieves can't be choosers," he said.
"They have to be." As he got out, she shifted over behind the steering wheel. "Hey, if you're not choosy, then you're not a thief. You're a trash collector."
While Ellie drifted along one aisle, pacing him, Spencer moved boldly from vehicle to vehicle, trying the doors. Each time that he found one unlocked, he leaned inside long enough to check for keys in the ignition, behind the sun visor and under the driver's seat. Watching his master through the side windows of the Bronco, Rocky whined as though with concern.
"Dangerous, yes," Ellie said. "I can't lie to the dog. But not half as dangerous as driving through the front of a supermarket with helicopters full of thugs on your tail. You've just got to keep this in perspective."
The 14th set of wheels that Spencer tried was a big black Chevy pickup with an extended cab that provided both front and back seats. He climbed into it, pulled the door shut, started the engine, and reversed out of the parking slot. Ellie parked the Bronco in the space that the Chevy had vacated. They needed only 15 seconds to transfer the guns, the duffel bag, and the dog to the pickup. Then they were on their way again. On the east side of the city, they started looking for any motel that appeared to have been recently constructed. The rooms in most older establishments were not computer-friendly. At a self-described motor lodge that looked new enough to have held its ribbon-cutting ceremony just hours ago, Ellie left Spencer and Rocky in the pickup while she went into the front office to ask the desk clerk if their accommodations would allow her to use her modem.
"I have a report due at my office in Cleveland by morning."
In fact, all rooms were properly wired for her needs. Using her best bear ID for the first time, she took a double with a queen-sized bed and paid cash in advance.
"How soon can we be on the road again?" Spencer asked as they parked in front of their unit.
45 minutes tops, probably half an hour," she promised.
"We're miles from where we took the pickup, but I have a bad feeling about hanging around here too long."
"You aren't the only one."
She couldn't help but notice the decor of the room even as she took Spencer's laptop computer out of the duffel bag, put it on the desk next to an arrangement of accessible plugs and phone jacks, and concentrated on getting it ready for business. Blue and black speckled carpet, blue and yellow striped draperies, green and blue checkered bedspread, blue and gold and silver wallpaper in a pale amoeboid pattern. It looked like army camouflage for an alien planet.
"While you're working on that," Spencer said, "I'll take Rocky out to do his business. He must be ready to burst."
"Doesn't seem in distress."
He'd be too embarrassed to let on.
At the door, he turned to her again and said,
"I saw a fast food places across the street. I'll walk over there and get us some burgers and stuff, too, if that sounds like it would hit the spot."
"Just buy plenty," she said.
While Spencer and the pooch were gone, Ellie accessed the AT&T central computer, which she had penetrated long ago and had explored in depth. Through AT&T's nationwide linkages, she had been able in the past to finesse her way into the computers of several regional phone companies at all ends of the country, although she'd never before tried to slide into the Colorado system. For a hacker, as for a concert pianist or an Olympic gymnast, however, training and practice were the keys to success, and she was extremely well-trained and well-practiced. When Spencer and Rocky returned after only 25 minutes, Ellie was already deep inside the regional system, scrolling rapidly down a dauntingly long list of payphone numbers with corresponding addresses that were arranged county by county. She settled on a phone at a service station in Montrose, Colorado, 66 miles south of Grand Junction. Manipulating the main switching system in the regional phone company, she rang the Grand Junction police while routing the call from their motel room through the service station payphone down in Montrose. She called the emergency number rather than the main police number just to be sure that the source address would appear on screen in front of the operator.
"Grand Junction Police."
Ellie began without any preamble. "We hijacked a Bell Jet Ranger helicopter in Cedar City, Utah earlier today." When the police operator attempted to interrupt with questions that would encourage a standard format report, Ellie shouted the woman down.
"Shut up, shut up. I'm only going to say this once, so you better listen or people will die."
She grinned at Spencer, who was opening bags of wonderfully fragrant food on the dinette table.
The chopper is now on the ground in the Colorado National Monument with the crew aboard. They're unhurt but tied up. If they have to spend the night out there, they'll freeze to death. I'll describe the landing site just once, and you better get the details right if you want to save their lives. She gave succinct directions and disconnected. Two things had been achieved. The three men in the Jet Ranger would be found soon, and the Grand Junction Police Department had an address in Montrose, 66 miles to the south, from which the emergency call had been made, indicating that Ellie and Spencer were either about to flee east on Federal Highway 50 toward Pueblo, or continue south on Federal Highway 550 toward Durango. Several state routes branched off those main arteries as well, providing enough possibilities to keep agency search teams fully occupied. Meanwhile, she and Spencer and Mr. Rocky Dog would be headed to Denver on Interstate 70. Dr. Sabrina Palmer was being difficult, which was no surprise to Roy. Before arriving at the prison, he had expected objections to his plans based on medical, security, and political grounds. The moment he had seen her office, he had known that vital financial considerations would weigh more heavily against him than all the genuinely ethical arguments that she might have pursued.
"I can't conceive of any circumstances related to the threat against the president that would require Stephen Ackblom's removal from this facility," she said crisply.
Though she had returned to the formidable leather chair, she no longer relaxed in it, but sat forward on the edge, arms on her crescent desk. Her manicured hands were alternately fisted on her blotter or busy with various pieces of lalique crystal, small animals, colorful fishes, that were arranged to one side of her blotter.
"He's an extremely dangerous individual, an arrogant and utterly selfish man who would never cooperate with you, even if there was something he could do to help you find his son, though I can't imagine what that would be."
As pleasant as he ever was, Roy said, "Dr. Palmer, with all due respect, it isn't for you to imagine or be told how he could help us or how we expect to win his cooperation. This is an urgent matter of national security. I'm not permitted to share any details with you, regardless of how much I might want to."
"This man is evil, Mr. Carter."
"Yes, I'm aware of his history."
"You aren't understanding me,"
Roy gently interrupted, pointing to one of the documents on her desk. "You have read the judicial order signed by a justice of the Colorado Supreme Court conveying Stephen Ackblom into my temporary custody."
"Yes, but..."
"I assume that when you left the room to make telephone calls, one of them was to confirm that signature?"
"Yes, and it's legitimate. He was still in his office, and he confirmed it personally."
In fact, it was a real signature. That particular justice lived in the agency's pocket. Sabrina Palmer was not satisfied.
"But what does your judge know about evil like this? What experience does he have with this particular man?"
Pointing to another document on the desk, Roy said, "And may I assume that you've confirmed the genuineness of the letter from my boss, the Secretary of the Treasury, you called Washington?"
"I didn't speak with him. No, of course not."
"He's a busy man, but there must have been an assistant."
"Yes," the doctor admitted grudgingly. "I spoke with one of his assistants who verified the request."
The signature of the Secretary of the Treasury had been forged. The assistant, one of a swarm of minions, was an agency sympathizer. He was no doubt still standing by in the secretary's office after hours to field another call on the private number that Roy had given to Sabrina Palmer, just in case she called again. Pointing to a third document on her desk, Roy said, "And this request from the First Deputy Attorney General?"
"Yes, I called him."
"I understand you've actually met Mr. Summerton."
"Yes, at a conference on the insanity plea and its effect on the health of the judicial system about 6 months ago."
"I trust Mr. Summerton was persuasive."
"Quite. Look, Mr. Carter, I have a call into the governor's office, and if we can just wait until—"
"I'm afraid we've no time to wait. As I've told you, the life of the President of the United States is at stake."
"This is a prisoner of exceptional—"
"Dr. Palmer," Roy said. His voice now had a steely edge, though he continued to smile. "You do not have to worry about losing your golden goose. I swear to you that he will be back in your care within 24 hours. Her green eyes fixed him with an angry stare, but she did not respond. "I hadn't heard that Stephen Ackblom has continued to paint since his incarceration," Roy said. Dr. Palmer's gaze flicked to the two men at the door, who were in convincingly rigid Secret Service postures, then returned to Roy.
"He produces a little work?
Yes,
not much, 2 or 3 pieces a year."
Worth millions at the current rate.
There is nothing unethical going on here, Mr. Carter.
I didn't imagine there was, Roy said innocently.
Of his own free will, without coercion of any sort, Mr. Ackblom assigns all rights to each of his new paintings to this institution, after he tires of it hanging in his cell. The proceeds from their sale are used entirely to supplement the funds that are budgeted to us by the state of Colorado. And these days, in this economy, the state generally underfunds prison operations of all kinds, as if the institutionalized don't deserve adequate care.
Roy slid one hand lightly, appreciatively, lovingly, along the glass-smooth radius edge of the $40,000 desk. Yes, I'm sure that without the lagniappe of Ackblom's art, things here would be grim indeed. She was silent again. Tell me, Doctor, in addition to the two or three major pieces that Ackblom produces each year, as he just sort of dabbles in his art to pass his entombed days, are there perhaps sketches, pencil studies, scraps of scrawlings that aren't worth the bother for him to assign to this institution? You know what I mean. Insignificant doodlings, preliminaries, worth hardly 10 or 20,000 each, which one might take home to hang on one's bathroom walls? Or even simply incinerate along with the rest of the garbage. Her hatred for him was so intense that he would not have been surprised if the blush that rose in her face had been hot enough to make her cotton-white skin explode into flames, as if it were not skin at all, but magician's flash paper. I adore your watch, he said, indicating the Piaget on her slender wrist. The rim of the face was enhanced by alternating diamonds and emeralds. The fourth document on the desk was a transferal order that acknowledged Roy's legal authority by direction of the Colorado Supreme Court to receive Ackblom into his temporary custody. Roy had already signed it in the limousine. Now Dr. Palmer signed it, too. Delighted, Roy said, "Is Ackblom on any medications, any antipsychotics that we should continue to give him?" She met his eyes again, and her anger was watered down with concern.
No antipsychotics. He doesn't need them. He isn't psychotic by any current psychological definition of the term. Mr. Carter, I'm trying my best to make you understand. This man exhibits none of the classic signs of psychosis. He is that most imprecisely defined creature, a sociopath, yes, but a sociopath by his actions only, by what we know him to have done, not by anything that he says or can be shown to believe. Administer any psychological test you want, and he comes through with flying colors, a perfectly normal guy, well-adjusted, balanced, not even markedly neurotic.
I understand he's been a model prisoner these 16 years.
That means nothing. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Look, I'm a medical doctor and a psychiatrist, but over the years, from observation and experience, I've lost all faith in psychiatry. Freud and Jung, they were both full of shit.
That crude word had shocking power coming from a woman as elegant as she.
Their theories of how the human mind works are worthless, exercises in self-justification, philosophies devised only to excuse their own desires. No one knows how the mind works. Even when we administer a drug and correct a mental condition, we only know that the drug is effective, not why. And in Ackblom's case, his behavior isn't based in a physiological problem any more than it is in a psychological problem.
You have no compassion for him?
She leaned across her desk, focusing intently on him. I tell you, Mr. Carter, there is evil in the world. Evil that exists without cause, without rationalization. Evil that doesn't arise from trauma or abuse or deprivation. Stephen Ackblom is, in my judgment, a prime example of evil. He is sane, utterly sane. He clearly knows the difference between right and wrong. He chose to do monstrous things, knowing they were monstrous, and even though he felt no psychological compulsion to do them.
You have no compassion for your patient? Roy asked again.
He isn't my patient, Mr. Carter. He's my prisoner.
However you choose to look at him, doesn't he deserve some compassion? A man who's fallen from such heights?
He deserves to be shot in the head and buried in an unmarked grave, she said bluntly.
She was not attractive anymore. She looked like a witch, raven-haired and pale, with eyes as green as those of certain cats.
But because Mr. Ackblom entered a guilty plea, and because it was easiest to commit him to this facility, the state supported the fiction that he was a sick man.
Of all the people Roy had met in his busy life, he had disliked few and had hated fewer still. For nearly everyone that he had ever met, he had found compassion in his heart, regardless of their shortcomings or personalities. But he flatly despised Dr. Sabrina Palmer. When he found time in his busy schedule, he would give her a comeuppance that would make what he'd done to Harris Decoteau seem merciful. Even if you can't find some compassion for the Stephen Ackblom who killed those people, Roy said, rising from his chair, I would think you could find some for the Stephen Ackblom who has been so generous to you.
He is evil.
She was unrelenting. He deserves no compassion. Just use him however you must, then return him.
Well, maybe you do know a thing or two about evil, Doctor.
The advantage I've taken of the arrangement here, she said coolly, is a sin, Mr. Carter, I know that. And one way or another, I'll pay for the sin. But there's a difference between a sinful act which springs from weakness and one that's pure evil. I am able to recognize that difference.
How handy for you, he said, and began to gather up the papers from her desk.
They sat on the motel bed, chowing down on Burger King burgers, French fries, and chocolate chip cookies. Rocky ate off a torn paper bag on the floor. That morning in the desert, now hardly 12 hours behind them, seemed to be an eternity in the past. Ellie and Spencer had learned so much about each other that they could eat in silence, enjoying the food without feeling the least awkward together. He surprised her, however, when, toward the end of their hurried meal, he expressed the desire to stop at the ranch outside Vale on their way to Denver. And surprised was not the word for it when he told her that he still owned the place. Maybe I've always known that I'd have to go back eventually, he said, unable to look at her. He put the last of his dinner aside, appetite lost. Sitting lotus fashion on the bed, he folded his hands on his right knee and stared at them as if they were more mysterious than artifacts from lost Atlantis. In the beginning, he continued, my grandparents held on to the place because they didn't want anyone to buy it and maybe make some god-awful tourist attraction out of it, or let the news media into those underground rooms for more morbid stories. The bodies had been removed, everything cleaned out, but it was still the place, could still attract media interest. After I went into therapy, which I stayed with for about a year, the therapist thought we should keep the property until I was ready to go back.
Why? Ellie wondered. Why ever go back?
He hesitated. Then,
because part of that night is a blank to me. I've never been able to remember what happened toward the end after I shot him.
What do you mean? You shot him and you ran for help and that was the end of it.
No.
What?
He shook his head, still staring at his hands. Very still hands, like hands of carved marble resting on his knee. Finally, he said, that's what I've got to find out. I've got to go back there, back down there, and find out. Because if I don't, I'm never going to be right with myself, or any good for you.
You can't go back there, not with the agency after you.
They wouldn't look for us there. They can't have found out who I was, who I really am. Michael, they can't know that.
They might, she said.
She went to the duffel bag and got the envelope of photographs that she had found on the deck of the Jet Ranger half under her seat. She presented them to him.
They found these in a shoebox in my cabin, he said. They probably just took them for reference. You wouldn't recognize my father. No one would. Not from this shot.
You can't be sure.
Anyway, I don't own the property under any identity they would associate with me, even if somehow they got into sealed court records and found out I changed my name from Ackblom. I hold it through an offshore corporation.
The agency is damned resourceful, Spencer.
Looking up from his hands, he met her eyes.
All right, I'm willing to believe they're resourceful enough to uncover all of it, given enough time. But surely not this quickly. That just means I've got more reason than ever to go there tonight. When am I going to get a chance again, after we go to Denver and to wherever we'll go after that? By the time I can return to Vale again, maybe they will have discovered I still own the ranch. Then I'll never be able to go back and finish this. We pass right by Vale on the way to Denver. It's off Interstate 70.
I know, she said, shakily, remembering that moment in the helicopter somewhere over Utah when she had sensed that he might not live through the night to share the morning with her.
He said, if you don't want to go there with me, we can work that out, too. But even if I could be sure the agency would never learn about the place, I'd have to go back tonight. Ellie, if I don't go back now, when I have the guts to face it, I might never work up the courage later. It's taken 16 years this time.
She sat for a while, staring at her own hands. Then she got up and went to the laptop, which was still plugged in and connected to the modem. She switched it on. He followed her to the desk.
What are you doing?
What's the address of the ranch? She asked.
It was a rural address rather than a street number. He gave it to her, then again, after she asked him to repeat it.
But why? What's this about?
What's the name of the offshore company?
Vanishment International.
You're kidding.
No.
And that's the name on the deed now, Vanishment International? That's how it would show on the tax records?
Yeah.
Spencer pulled up another chair beside hers and sat on it as Rocky came sniffing around to see if they had more food.
Ellie, will you open up?
I'm going to try to crack into public land records out there, she said. I need to call up a parcel map if I can get one. I've got to figure out the exact geographic coordinates of the place.
Is that all supposed to mean something?
By God, if we're going in there, if we're taking a risk like that, then we're going to be as heavily armed as possible. She was talking to herself more than to him. We're going to be ready to defend ourselves against anything.
What are you talking about?
Too complicated. Later. Now I need some silence.
Her quick hands worked magic on the keyboard. Spencer watched the screen as Ellie moved from Grand Junction to the courthouse computer in Vail. Then she peeled the county's data system onion one layer at a time. Wearing a slightly large suit of clothes provided by the agency and a top coat identical to those of his three companions, in shackles and handcuffs, the famous and infamous Stephen Ackblom sat beside Roy in the back of the limousine. The artist was 53, but appeared to be only a few years older than when he had been on the front pages of newspapers, where the sensation mongers had variously dubbed him the Vampire of Vail, the Madman of the Mountains, and the Psycho Michelangelo. Although a trace of gray had appeared at his temples, his hair was otherwise black and glossy and not in the least receding. His handsome face was remarkably smooth and youthful, and his brow was unmarked. A soft smile line curved downward from the outer flare of each nostril, and fans of fine crinkles spread at the outer corners of his eyes. None of that aged him whatsoever. In fact, it gave the impression that he suffered few troubles, but enjoyed many sources of amusement. As in the photograph that Roy had found in the Malibu cabin, and as in all the pictures that had appeared in newspapers and magazines 16 years ago, Stephen Ackblom's eyes were his most compelling feature. Nevertheless, the arrogance that Roy had perceived, even in the shadowy publicity still, was not there now. If it ever had been, in its place was a quiet self-confidence. Likewise, the menace that could be read into any photograph when one knew the accomplishments of the man was not in the least visible in person. His gaze was direct and clear, but not threatening. Roy had been surprised and not displeased to discover an uncommon gentleness in Ackblom's eyes, and a poignant empathy as well, from which it was easy to infer that he was a person of considerable wisdom, whose understanding of the human condition was deep, complete. Even in the limousine's odd and inadequate illumination, which came from the recessed lights under the heel kicks of the car seats and from the low wattage sconces in the doorposts, Ackblom was a presence to be reckoned with, although in no way that the press, in its sensation-seeking, had begun to touch upon. He was quiet, but his taciturnity had no quality of inarticulateness or distraction. Quite the opposite. His silences spoke more than other men's most polished flights of oratory, and he was always and unmistakably observant and alert. He moved little, never fidgeted. Occasionally, when he accompanied a comment with a gesture, the movement of his cuffed hands was so economical that the chain between his wrists clinked softly, if at all. His stillness was not rigid, but relaxed, not limp, but full of quiescent power. It was impossible to sit at his side and be unaware that he possessed tremendous intelligence. He all but hummed with it, as if his mind was a dynamic machine of such omnipotence that it could move worlds and alter the cosmos. In his entire 33 years, Roy Miro had met only 2 people whose mere physical presence had engendered in him an approximation of love. The first had been Eve Marie Jammer. The second was Stephen Ackblom. Both in the same week, in this wondrous February, destiny had become indeed his cloak and his companion. He sat at Stephen Ackblom's side, discreetly enthralled. He wanted desperately to make the artist aware that he, Roy Miro, was a person of profound insights and exceptional accomplishments. Rink and Fordyce,
Tarkenton and Allmire had ceased to exist upon leaving Dr. Palmer's office, seemed not to be as charmed by Ackblom as Roy was, or charmed at all. Sitting in the rear-facing seats, they appeared uninterested in what the artist had to say. Fordyce closed his eyes for long periods of time, as though meditating. Rink stared out the window, although he could have seen nothing whatsoever of the night through the darkly tinted glass. On those rare occasions when a gesture of Ackblom's rang a soft clink from his cuffs, and on those even rarer occasions when he shifted his feet enough to rattle the shackles that connected his ankles, Fordyce's eyes popped open like the counterbalanced eyes of a doll, and Rink's head snapped from the unseen night to the artist. Otherwise, they seemed to pay no attention to him. Depressingly, Rink and Fordyce clearly had formed their opinions of Ackblom based on what drivel they had gleaned from the media, not from what they could observe for themselves. Their denseness was no surprise, of course. Rink and Fordyce were men not of ideas, but of action, not of passion, but of crude desire. The agency had need of their type, although they were sadly without vision, pitiable creatures of woeful limitations, who would one day inch the world closer to perfection by departing it. "At the time, I was quite young, only 2 years older than your son," Roy said, "but I understood what you were trying to achieve." "And what was that?" Ackblom asked. His voice was in the lower tenor range, mellow, with a timbre that suggested he might have had a career as a singer if he'd wished. Roy explained his theories about the artist's work, that those eerie and compelling portraits weren't about people's hateful desires building like boiler pressure beneath their beautiful surfaces, but were meant to be viewed with the still lives, and together were a statement about the human desire and struggle for perfection. And if your work with living subjects resulted in their attainment of a perfect beauty, even for a brief time before they died, then your crimes weren't crimes at all, but acts of charity, acts of profound compassion, because too few people in this world will ever know any moment of perfection in their entire lives. Through torture, you gave those 41, your wife as well, I assume, a transcendent experience. Had they lived, they might eventually have thanked you. Roy was speaking sincerely, although previously he had believed that Ackblom had been misguided in the means by which he had pursued the grail of perfection. That was before he had met the man. Now he felt ashamed of his woeful underestimation of the artist's talent and keen perception. In the rear-facing seats, neither Rink nor Fordyce evinced any surprise or interest in anything that Roy said. In their service with the agency, they had heard so many outrageous lies, all so well and sincerely delivered, that they undoubtedly believed their boss was only playing with Ackblom, carefully manipulating a madman into a degree of cooperation required from him to ensure the success of the current operation. Roy was in the singular and thrilling position of being able to express his deepest feelings with the knowledge that Ackblom would fully comprehend him, even while Rink and Fordyce would think he was engaged only in Machiavellian games. Roy did not go so far as to reveal his personal commitment to compassionate treatment of the sadder cases that he met in his many travels. Stories like those about the Bettenfields in Beverly Hills, Chester and Guinevere in Burbank, and the paraplegic and his wife outside the restaurant in Vegas might strike even Rink and Fordyce as too specific in detail to be impromptu fabrications invented to win the artist's confidence. "The world would be an infinitely better place," Roy opined, restricting his observations to safely general concepts, "if the breeding stock of humanity was thinned out. Eliminate the most imperfect specimens first, always working up from the bottom, until those permitted to survive are the people who most closely meet the standards for the ideal citizens needed to build a gentler and more enlightened society. Don't you agree?"
"The process would certainly be fascinating," Ackblom replied.
Roy took the comment to be approving.
"Yes, wouldn't it?"
"Always supposing that one was on the committee of eliminators," the artist said, "and not among those to be judged."
"Well, of course, that's a given." Ackblom favored him with a smile.
"Then what fun!" They were driving over the mountains on Interstate 70 rather than flying to Vail. The trip would require less than 2 hours by car, returning across Denver from the prison to Stapleton, waiting for flight clearance, and making the journey by air would actually have taken longer. Besides, the limousine was more intimate and quieter than the jet. Roy was able to spend more quality time with the artist than he would have been able to enjoy in the Lear. Gradually, mile by mile, Roy Miro came to understand why Stephen Ackblom affected him as powerfully as Eve had affected him. Although the artist was a handsome man, nothing about his physical appearance could qualify as a perfect feature. Yet, in some way, he was perfect. Roy sensed it, a radiance, a subtle harmony, soothing vibrations. In some aspect of his being, Ackblom was without the slightest flaw. For the time being, the artist's perfect quality or virtue remained tantalizingly mysterious. But Roy was confident of discovering it by the time they arrived at the ranch outside Vail. The limousine cruised into even higher mountains, through vast primeval forests encrusted with snow, upward into silvery moonlight, all of which the tinted windows reduced to a smoky blur. The tires hummed. While Spencer drove the stolen black pickup east on Interstate 70 out of Grand Junction, Ellie slumped in her seat and worked feverishly on the laptop which she had plugged into the cigarette lighter. The computer was elevated on a pillow that they had filched from the motel. Periodically, she consulted a printout of the parcel map and other information that she had obtained about the ranch. "What are you doing?" he asked again.
"Calculations."
"What calculations?"
"Shh. Rocky's sleeping on the back seat."
From her duffel bag, she had produced diskettes of software which she'd installed in the machine. Evidently, they were programs of her own design, adapted to his laptop while he had lingered in delirium for more than 2 days in the Mojave. When he had asked her why she had backed up her own computer, now gone with the rover, with his quite different system, she had said, "Former Girl Scout, remember? We always like to be prepared." He had no idea what her software allowed her to do. Across the screen flickered formulas and graphs. Holographic globes of the Earth revolved at her command, and from them she extracted areas for enlargement and closer examination. Vail was only 3 hours away. Spencer wished that they could use the time to talk, to discover more about each other. 3 hours was such a short time, especially if it proved to be the last 3 hours they ever had together. Chapter 14. When he returned to his brother's house from his walk through the hilly streets of Westwood, Harris DeCoteau did not mention the encounter with the tall man in the blue Toyota. For one thing, it seemed half like a dream, improbable. Besides, he hadn't been able to make up his mind whether that stranger had been a friend or an enemy. He didn't want to alarm Darius or Jessica. Late that afternoon, after Ondine and Willa had returned from the mall with their aunt, and after Darius and Bonnie's son Martin came home from school, Darius decided that they needed to have a little fun. He insisted on packing everyone, the seven of them, into the VW microbus, which he had so lovingly restored with his own hands, to go to a movie and then to dinner at Hamlet Gardens. Neither Harris nor Jessica wanted to go to movies and dinners in restaurants where every dollar spent was a dollar that they were mooching. Not even Ondine and Willa, as resilient as any teenagers, had yet bounced back from the trauma of the SWAT attack on Friday or from having been put out of their own home by federal marshals. Darius was adamant that a movie and dinner at Hamlet Gardens were precisely the right medicines for what ailed them, and his persistence was one of the qualities that made him an exceptional attorney. That was how, at 6:15 Monday evening, Harris came to be in a theater with a boisterous crowd, unable to grasp the humor in scenes that everyone else found hilarious, and succumbing to another attack of claustrophobia. The darkness, so many people in one room, the body heat of the crowd. He was afflicted first by an inability to draw deep breath, and then by a mild dizziness. He feared that worse would swiftly follow. He whispered to Jessica that he had to use the bathroom. When worry crossed her face, he patted her arm and smiled reassuringly, and then he got the hell out of there. The men's room was deserted. At one of the four sinks, Harris turned on the cold water. He bent over the bowl and splashed his face repeatedly, trying to cool down from the overheated theater and chase away the dizziness. The noise of the running water prevented him from hearing the other man enter. When he looked up, he was no longer alone. About 30, Asian, wearing loafers and jeans and a dark blue sweater with prancing red reindeer, the stranger stood 2 sinks away. He was combing his hair. He met Harris's eyes in the mirror, and he smiled. "Sir, may I give you something to think about?" Harris recognized the question as the very one with which the tall man in the blue Toyota had initially addressed him. Startled, he backed away from the sink so fast that he crashed against the swinging door at one of the toilet stalls. He tottered, almost fell, but caught the hingeless side of the jamb to keep his balance. For a while, the Japanese economy was so hot that it gave the world the idea that maybe big government and big business must work hand in glove.
"Who are you?"
Harris asked, quicker off the mark with this man than he had been with the first. Ignoring the question, the smiling stranger said, "So now we hear about national industrial policies. Big business and government strike deals every day. Push my social programs and enhance my power," says the politician, "and I'll guarantee your profit."
"What does any of this matter to me?"
"Be patient, Mr. Decoteau."
"But union members get screwed because government conspires with their bosses. Small businessmen get screwed. Everyone too little to play in the $100 billion league. Now the Secretary of Defense wants to use the military as an arm of economic policy."
Harris returned to the sink where he had left the cold water running. He turned it off.
"A business-government alliance enforced by the military and domestic police. Once this was called fascism. Will we see fascism in our time, Mr. Decoteau, or is this something new, not to worry?"
Harris was trembling. He realized that his face and hands were dripping, and he yanked paper towels from the dispenser.
"And if it's something new, Mr. Decoteau, is it going to be something good?"
"Maybe.
Maybe we'll go through a time of adjustment, and thereafter everything will be delightful."
He nodded, smiling, as if considering that possibility.
"Or maybe this new thing will turn out to be a new kind of hell." "I don't care about any of this," Harris said angrily. "I'm not political."
"You don't need to be. To protect yourself, you only need to be informed."
"Look, whoever you are, I just want my house back. I want my life like it was. I want to go on just the way everything was."
"That will never transpire, Mr. Decoteau."
"Why is this happening to me?"
"Have you read the novels of Philip K. Dick, Mr. Decoteau?"
"Who? No."
Harris felt more than ever as if he had crossed into White Rabbit and Cheshire Cat territory. The stranger shook his head with dismay.
"The futuristic world Mr. Dick wrote about is the world we are sliding into. It's a scary place, this Dixian world. More than ever, a person needs friends."
"Are you a friend?" Harris demanded. "Who are you people?"
"Be patient and consider what I've said."
The man started for the door. Harris reached out to stop him, but decided against it. A moment later, he was alone. His bowels were suddenly in turmoil. He hadn't lied to Jessica after all. He really did need to use the bathroom. Approaching Vail, high in the western Rockies, Roy Miro used the phone in the limousine to call the number of the cellular unit that Gary Duval had given him earlier.
"Clear?" he asked.
"No sign of them yet," Duval said.
"We're almost there."
"You really think they're going to show?"
The stolen Jet Ranger and its crew had been found in the Colorado National Monument. A call from the woman to the Grand Junction police had been traced to Montrose, indicating that she and Spencer Grant were fleeing south toward Durango. Roy didn't believe it. He knew that telephone calls could be deceptively routed with the assistance of a computer. He trusted not in a traced call, but in the power of the past. Where the past and the present met, he would find the fugitives.
"They'll show," Roy said. "Cosmic forces are with us tonight."
"Cosmic forces?"
Duval said, as if playing into a joke, waiting for the punchline.
"They'll show," Roy repeated, and he disconnected. Beside Roy, Stephen Ackblom sat silent and serene.
"We'll be there in just a few minutes," Roy told him.
Ackblom smiled. "There's no place like home."
Spencer had been driving for nearly an hour and a half before Ellie switched off the computer and unplugged it from the cigarette lighter. A dew of perspiration beaded her forehead, although the interior of the truck was not overheated.
"God knows if I'm mounting a good defense or planning a double suicide," she said. "Could go either way, but now it's there for us to use if we have to."
"Use what?"
"I'm not going to tell you," she said bluntly. "It'll take too much time. Besides, you'll try to talk me out of it, which would be a waste of time. I know the arguments against it, and I've already rejected them."
"And this makes an argument so much easier when you handle both sides of it." She remained somber.
"If worse comes to worst, I'll have no choice but to use it, no matter how insane that seems."
Rocky had awakened in the back seat a short while ago, and to him Spencer said,
"Pal, you're not confused back there, are you?"
"Ask me anything else, but not about that," Ellie said. "If I talk about it, if I even think too much about it, then I'll be too damn scared to do it when the time comes, if the time comes. I hope to God we don't need it."
Spencer had never heard her babble before. She usually kept tight control of herself. Now she was spooking him. Panting, Rocky poked his head between the front seats, one ear up, one down, refreshed and interested.
I didn't think you were confused, Spencer told him. Me, I'm twice as befuddled as a lightning bug bashing itself to bits to get out of an old mayonnaise jar. But I suppose that higher forms of intelligence, like the canine species, would have no trouble figuring out what she's ranting about. Ellie stared at the road ahead, rubbing absent-mindedly at her chin with the knuckles of her right hand. She had said that he could ask her about anything except that, whatever that might be, so he took her up on it. Where was Bess Bear going to settle down before I mucked things up? Where were you going to take that rover and make a new life?
Wasn't going to settle again, she said, proving that she was listening. I gave up on that. Sooner or later they'd find me if I stay in one place too long. I spent a lot of the money I had, and some from friends, to buy that rover and the gear in it. With that, I figured I could keep moving and go just about anywhere.
I'll pay for the rover.
That's not what I was after.
I know, but what's mine is yours anyway.
Oh, when did that happen?
No strings attached, he said.
I like to pay my own way.
No point discussing it.
What you say is final, huh?
No, what the dog says is final.
This was Rocky's decision?
He takes care of all my finances.
Rocky grinned. He liked hearing his name. Because it's Rocky's idea, she said, I'll keep an open mind.
Spencer said, Why do you call Summerton a cockroach? Why does that annoy him particularly?
Tom's got a phobia about insects. All kinds of insects. Even a housefly can make him squirm, but he's especially uptight about cockroaches. When he sees one, and they used to have an infestation at the ATF when he was there, he goes off the deep end. It's almost comic, like in a cartoon when an elephant spots a mouse. Anyway, a few weeks after Danny and my folks were killed, and after I gave up trying to approach reporters with what I knew, I called old Tom at his office in the Department of Justice, just rang him up from a payphone in Midtown Chicago.
Good grief.
The most private of his private lines, the one he picks up himself,
surprised him.
He tried to play innocent, keep me talking, until he could have me whacked right at that payphone. I told him he shouldn't be so afraid of cockroaches, since he was one himself. Told him that someday I'd stomp him flat, kill him. And I meant what I said. Someday, somehow I'll send him straight to hell. Spencer glanced at her. She was staring at the night ahead, still brooding. Slender, so pleasing to the eye, in some ways as delicate as any flower, she was nevertheless as fierce and tough as any Special Forces soldier that Spencer had ever known.
He loved her beyond all reason, without reservation, without qualification, with a passion immeasurable, loved every aspect of her face, loved the sound of her voice, loved her singular vitality, loved the kindness of her heart and the agility of her mind, loved her so purely and intensely that sometimes when he looked at her, a hush seemed to fall across the world. He prayed that she was a favored child of fate, destined to have a long life, because if she died before he did, there would be no hope for him, no hope at all. He drove east into the night, past Rifle and Silt and Newcastle and Glenwood Springs. The interstate highway frequently followed the bottoms of deep, narrow canyons with sheer walls of seamed stone. In daylight, it was some of the most breathtaking scenery on the planet. In February darkness, those soaring ramparts of rock pressed close, black monoliths that denied him the choice of going left or right and that funneled him toward higher places, toward dire confrontations so inevitable that they seemed to have been waiting to unfold since before the universe had exploded into existence. From the floor of that crevasse, only a ribbon of sky was visible, sprinkled with a meagerness of stars, as though heaven could accommodate no more souls and would soon close its gates forever. Roy touched a button in the armrest beside him. The car window purred down. "Is it as you remember?" he asked the artist. As they turned off the two-lane country road, Ackblom leaned past Roy to look outside. Toward the front of the property, untrammeled snow mantled the paddocks that surrounded the stables. No horses had been boarded there in 22 years since Jennifer's death, because horses had been her love, not her husband's. The fencing was well maintained and so white that it was only dimly visible against the frosted fields. The bare driveway was flanked by waist-high walls of snow that had been pushed there by a plow. Its course was serpentine. At Stephen Ackblom's request, the driver stopped at the house rather than proceeding directly to the barn.